We've got the weekly wrap today. We've got a winter whiteout, and we've got water in Flint, Michigan. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday today, the 22nd of January. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Big giant snowstorm aside, and we are going to get to that later, by the way. But snowstorm aside, here in the land of business and the economy, it has been, I think you could safely say, quite a week. So, 5 days to talk about, 5 minutes of live radio in which to do it. Ready, go! Lynette Lopez is with Business Insider. David Gura is at Bloomberg. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so the clock's ticking here, Gura. I want you to look back on the last 5 days and tell me what is the one thing that either has you worried or most stuck with you.
China.
Is your name Gura?
In.
Come on.
Go ahead.
China. No. We're going to flow free today.
All right.
There's a lot to talk about. We've seen stocks go wild.
Yep.
We know the junk bond market is going crazy
it's
as well.
Bananas.
Still crazy outflows. Bananas. China, we're like, hey, can you guys reform already so you're just not bleeding industries all over the place and losing money? And they're like, eh, we'll get around to it. And everybody's just like waving their hands in front of their faces.
She's literally waving
air.
Her hands.
I'm right doing
it.
Imagine
right the beauty now. Of radio. All right, Gura, take us back to rationality here. What are you what are you most worried about? Because Lynette's going to get her moment in a minute. I'm going to come back to the China thing. But I want to know what sticks with you.
Yeah, you know, the volatility was crazy before we started talking. We were both exhaling in tandem after this week. I mean, we saw markets really take a dive and come back up. So, you know, if I'm worried about anything, I guess I would say China as well. I'll jump on that.
Wow, all right,
we got some intel on that this week. We heard from China's vice president. He was saying that the government is going to intervene more. To sort of stave off more speculation. So maybe some better good feelings about that.
So, Lynette, is it that you don't think they know what they're doing over there or that there will be contagion? Because those are two different things.
I think that it's both. I think that no one knows what China is doing. And Christine Lagarde and Gary Cohn,
the head
everybody
of the IMF.
Over
and they can't say what they're doing.
They've always said, hey, can you guys give us a heads up? And China's like, eh, we don't really operate like that. We just can't do what we want. I think that there's a sense that no one knows how this is being managed. There's definitely a sense of contagion, and I think all of that comes from the fact that the yuan is now in play. China has pulled all the levers that it can to ease its economy, to keep money flowing, and now it's like, all right, now we have to mess with the currency, or rather, you know, make sure that the currency is where we want it so that we can continue our operations and reforms as we see fit.
All right, David, let me take you to oil, which a lot of people were talking about as being responsible for some of the volatility this week. Oil actually up like 9% today. I'm not going to ask you whether we've hit a bottom, but do you think we can safely now move past the worst of it?
Well, in effect, you're asking me if we've hit a bottom.
Well,
I
sort of am,
by saying that.
That's true.
But,
so answer the bottom question.
You know, I've been talking to people about this all week. I think that we're getting close, and we haven't brought up Davos yet, and obviously we have Chinese going to Davos 2 weeks later. Nor will we. Sorry that I did that. I think that we did see some movement there in large part because we had indications from Mario Draghi yesterday from the ECB indicating that there's going to be some more monetary policy stimulus, and there are people now thinking that's going to happen in Japan as well. So some more confidence restored to the oil market. I think people are desperate. A lot of people are desperate for the oil market to go up, and we had the sanctions lifted on Iran last weekend. News today that they'd brokered a deal with a Greek petroleum company, so they're starting to put their oil into the global market a bit.
But these are all supply side solutions, and we're not talking about demand side solutions. And that's
still have a lot of oil hanging around. How
do we get people to consume more? How do we? China's already like hands up. We're not doing
we've
it.
Got a snowstorm
we're slowing
coming.
Down. We've got a snow. I'm not leaving my house.
And it's not even snowing in New York yet. All right.
I've gotten all the essentials for New York City, which is vodka, and also vodka.
But that's a whole different show. All right.
Different
we have 20 seconds left. I'm putting you guys on the clock. It's the return of What Is Janet Yellen Thinking? Five words or less. Gura, ready, go.
Five words or less. Did we make a mistake?
Did we make a mistake? Ooh, all right, because they meet next week. Lynette, up to you. You get the last five words.
Can I catch a break?
Six words.
You guys are, can I catch a break? That's five.
Okay,
that's
sorry.
Five. David Gura at Bloomberg. Even
Gura's
though he
never
can't
been
count,
on with me before. He doesn't know how I
Lynette
do
Lynette Lopez
it.
At Business Insider. Have a good weekend, you guys.
Thank you, Kai.
All right, be Bye, good. Kai. On Wall Street today, what goes down must come up or something like that. We'll have the details. We should have those guys on every week when we do the numbers. All right, so let's pick up with something that Gura and Lynette and I were talking about back there, the global economy. 2015 was the year money ran screaming from emerging markets. You actually heard Lynette say this, outflows there she was talking about in that first thing about China. And we're talking outflows in a very big way, $735 billion that left emerging markets. That's according to the Institute for International Finance. And the biggest loser by far, think about what Lynette said, was China. The thing is that Beijing's got long-standing rules called capital controls that try, emphasis on the word try here, to keep too much money from leaving that country. Other places, Saudi Arabia and Nigeria, to name just two, have recently started trying to do the same thing. So Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes a look at capital controls, how they work, and how they don't.
When people think a bank might fail, often their first reaction is to sprint and get their money out. So the bank might close temporarily or limit how much customers can take out to keep things from spiraling. Capital controls are similar. They're regulations that try and moderate how much money enters or leaves a country.
That's not a bad metaphor.
Jonathan Austria is with the International Monetary Fund. He says it's tough to say how effective these controls are.
You really only want to put controls on capital outflows in sort of very extreme crisis situations.
Like Iceland did in 2008 after its banking system collapsed. Michael Klein is a professor at the Fletcher School at Tufts University.
What the country did was put in a very wide range of controls over virtually all assets. And Iceland was able to recover more quickly, I think, than it would have been had the money actually left the country.
But Klein says Iceland is definitely more exception than rule. He says, in general, long-term controls tend to work better than short-term reactionary ones, which people often find ways to get around. And these controls, they can really freak out investors, says Anusha Chari. She's an economics professor at the University of North Carolina.
It does have the unintended consequence of making foreign investors less likely to invest in your country in the future. And as far as your domestic citizens are concerned, if that restriction is lifted at some point, there's going to be this temptation to get the money out when you can.
Which means figuring out when to lift controls once they're in place can be really, really tricky. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
American Express is as iconic a financial brand as it gets. But for Amex executives today, the tagline could have been, don't leave home at all. It's brutal out there. The company reported a 38% drop in profits yesterday after the bell. And by the time things were all said and done today, shares were down 12%. CEO Kenneth Chenault cited, quote, intense competition in the payments industry. Marketplace's Mitchell Harmon has more on this.
Profits at American Express are being squeezed by merchants who don't want to pay high fees anymore when they take the card, and by customers who want ever more rewards from the company for using it. Jim Sinegal at Morningstar points to Amex's recent loss of an exclusive partnership with Costco.
American Express, when it was negotiating against small restaurants, for example, they really had a lot of bargaining power. Now Amex is talking to the Costcos and the Walmarts of the world, a handful of big airlines, and their bargaining position isn't as strong as it's been in the past.
Then there are consumers who hate high fees and use the web to shop for the lowest interest rates and the most free bonus miles and all the rest. Plus, says Matt Schultz at creditcards.com, Amex's gold and platinum cards, they're losing their shine with big spenders who used to be the company's bread and butter. Maybe we should say foie gras and caviar.
You have the MasterCard Black Card, the Citi Prestige Card. You're seeing other banks and other issuers play in that playground that used to be really dominated by American Express.
But Eric Oja at S&P Capital IQ thinks profits will turn up again for Amex and the credit card industry overall in time.
As the American consumer has paid down a lot of debt and FICO scores have increased, spending will also increase.
And Oja says a change of management at Amex to deal with these big changes in the industry wouldn't hurt either. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The who knew what when about lead in the water system in Flint, Michigan took another turn today. One high-ranking official at the Environmental Protection Agency has resigned, and the head of the EPA, Gina McCarthy is her name, she told Michigan Governor Rick Snyder that her agency is going to be taking over the monitoring of the city's water supply. The host of our weekend show, Lizzie O'Leary, is in Flint. Take a look around and get a sense of what it's like on the ground. Hey, Lizzie.
Hi, Kai.
Tell me where you are and what's going on.
I am at a water distribution center at one of the firehouses here in Flint. And basically what happens is if you live here, you drive up, show your ID, and the National Guard gives you one case of water per household per day. You can also get a lead testing kit and a filter to go on your sink that's supposed to screen out lead. We've talked to a bunch of people. I want to play you the sound of one mother I talked to, Lydia Cruz, who is here with her 3-year-old daughter, Jada, just about how worried she is about taking care of her daughter.
Yeah.
That's kind of scary that, you know, she doesn't know any better. She could drink the water while she's taking a bath, so that's horrifying, knowing that she could get some type of brain damage or, you know, affect her learning disability and all that stuff.
She hasn't taken her child to the doctor yet. Her daughter goes to school outside the city boundaries, so that school isn't affected by the water crisis in the same way. But, yeah, it's really scary if you're a parent here.
Just to be clear, you get a case per day, so you got to go back every morning, right?
You've got to go back every morning, and the National Guard guys have been telling me it's really crowded early in the morning, really crowded when school lets out, and you can probably hear behind me they're moving pallets of water around.
Let's say I run a small business in Flint. What's going on there? What happens?
You are very worried. Look, a lot of the places we've been, you know, cafes, coffee shops, restaurants, they've got signs up saying whether or not they're using city water, whether they're using bottled water. One of the people I talked to here at the distribution center yesterday works at the Flint Farmers Market. She runs an urban farm here, and she was saying she's been nervous since they switched over to the Flint River water 2 years ago and has used water from a well since then. Her name is Roxanne Adair. I want to play you that.
Okay.
The day that they switched over, you could smell the difference, you could taste the difference, and when water comes out of my tap that is brown, I don't care if you drink it on live television and tell me that it's safe, it's pretty common sense that, you know, something is not right.
Yeah.
Roxanne Adair also told us that her business has taken a big hit. She was talking to the other people at the farmers market, and she said, look, it's decimated what they were doing. This is her talking about how sales have been.
Lately, it's been financially really difficult. Our sales aren't as great. We're still paying rent. We're still paying insurance. We're still paying all of the bills that we have been paying. But if our sales aren't up, then we all struggle.
There are various states of emergency that have been declared, disasters that have been declared. There's money coming from the feds, right?
There is money coming from the feds, about $80 million, and that comes from sort of a general fund for infrastructure that the White House folks told me today. Essentially, that gets sent to the state of Michigan, and then Michigan decides how they want to use that $80 million. Some of that will be, they think, in low-cost loans, but, you know, there's still a big, big mess here that probably goes far beyond $80
million. Well, give me a price tag. I mean, what are people saying?
Well, one of the questions is, do they have to overhaul the system entirely? And in that case, the price tag could be somewhere between $700 million and $1 billion. And get this, Kai, they would have to pull up the lead service lines. But the city of Flint is very old, and so are their records. That means they don't necessarily know where the lead service lines are.
Lizzie O'Leary, the host of Marketplace Weekend, out doing some reporting this week in Flint. More to come from her next week on this program and on Marketplace Weekend next week. Lizzie, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up.
Well, they knew it. It could not be Downton Abbey.
But it could come right after it on Sunday night's Mercy Street director Roxanne Dawson straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers.
The Dow Industrial's up 210 points today. 1.3% closed at 16,093. The NASDAQ regained 119 points. That's 2.2%, 4,591. The S&P 500 added 37 points, 2%, ended things at 1906. So for the week, the Dow actually finished up 0.7%. The NASDAQ jumped 2.3%. The S&P 500 was 1.4% higher. The coming blizzard lit a fire under oil prices. Barrel of crude is up 9% and thus heated up energy stocks. Devon Energy bubbled up 6%. Chevron advanced 3%. Tech stocks got some of their mojo back. Apple, as it usually does, bulked up before its quarterly earnings announcement. That'll be next week. Shares added more than 5%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Okay, so the snowstorm. It is, as we all know, going to be a big one. So big in Washington, D.C. that the city's metro system has already shut down, as have government and private sector offices all over town.
You have reached the office of Congresswoman Norton. The office will be closed Friday, January the 22nd, due to the predicted snowstorm. Please have a safe weekend.
It's easy for those of us not in the path of this thing to make fun, but to be clear here, storms like this are dangerous. They can also literally change the way we live and what we expect from our public officials, big city mayors in particular. Yoni Applebaum, the Washington bureau chief at the Atlantic magazine, has written recently about the Great White Hurricane of 1888. So we got him on the phone. Yoni, it's good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So tell us about this Great White Hurricane of 1888.
Well, it was a cataclysmic storm. It killed 400 people, it sank 200 ships, and it paralyzed the northeastern United States for days on end.
And it was the thing that broke urban Americans out of this, I guess, island of safety they thought they lived in, right?
Yeah, they were really proud of all their newfangled contrivances, all of the electric wires strung from house to house, the street railroads. Urban life seemed like a safe place to be. And the storm brought home to them that the very things that made their urban existence so pleasant on a daily basis made them uniquely vulnerable to natural disasters.
And as they're digging out from these, what was it, like a 52-foot snowdrift in Brooklyn or something, right? As they're digging out, what do they ask of their public officials and their leadership?
Well, up until then, mayors had hunkered down for storms and come out a few days later. They'd encourage people to clean up the mess on their own. But that turned out not to be possible with a storm of this scale hitting urban areas. It took a collective effort to dig out the city, and people started to use blizzards as the yardstick by which they measured the performance of their municipal governments.
What did mayors do in the past? Did they just kind of sit there and let things happen? I mean, it's not like the first snowstorm ever was 1888.
More or less, though. They'd sometimes send rollers out into the street to make way for sleighs and sleds, but you couldn't maintain the kind of urban infrastructure that America was developing if you called on people to shovel out their own sidewalks. If you're going to have mass transit, something had to clear the tracks. If you're going to have an electric grid, you're going to have to bury the wires so they weren't so vulnerable. And that's exactly what they did after the storm. They put in miles of pneumatic tubes underneath the streets of New York to ensure that the mail could go through. Hmm. They found lots of ways to make cities more resilient, and that meant a more robust local government.
And hence, now we have 24 or 36 hours in advance of this storm, Mayor Bowser in Washington and Mayor de Blasio in New York calling states of emergency and telling everybody to prepare for Armageddon, basically.
Most of the time, it's really hard to tell how good a job your mayor is doing. But you know if that street's not shoveled. You know if it takes a week to send a plow down your side street. And so mayors try to get out ahead of these storms these days. They try to convince their electorates they're doing everything they possibly can to prepare for the storm before it hits.
And here we are 120-something years after the storm of 1888 with all the problems big city mayors have, and they're still judged by snowstorms.
They are, because it's still awfully hard to get around the streets if there's 52 feet of snow drifted up against a wall.
Yoni Applebaum, he is the Washington bureau chief at the Atlantic magazine. Yoni, thanks very much.
Nice to be with you, Guy.
I say period piece on public television, you say Downton Abbey, right? Yes, of course you do. The latest period drama to launch on PBS, however, is in fact American-made, set not on a great estate at the turn of the last century, but in an army hospital near the front lines of the Civil War. It's called Mercy Street. It's the first American-produced drama to air on PBS in more than a decade. And the pilot and the episode airing this coming Sunday night were directed by Roxanne Dawson. Some among you will know her better as B'Elanna Torres from Star Trek Voyager, but since then she has built a rather extensive career directing in television. Roxanne, thanks so much for coming into the studio.
Good to be here.
Tell me what it's like to go from being an actor to a director. How do you do that?
Well, you step on the other side of the camera to begin with.
Which has got to be weird, right? I mean, you know.
Yeah, it's a little strange. It's, but I've always been a bit bossy and controlling, so it kind of fits with my character. But directing had always interested me. Even I started in the theater, and so I directed a bit in the theater, was a member of Circle Repertory in New York. And so stepping on the other side of the camera was really not that different for me.
So tell me now about Mercy Street. It is, as I said in the introduction, the first American-made drama on PBS in 10-something years.
Yeah.
I imagine there's some pressure here.
Yeah, just a little bit. Just a little bit. Oh, my goodness. It was so extraordinary to work on this. I just fell in love with the scripts when I first read them. I think the biggest pressure was that we didn't have a lot of money. Mm-hmm. We shot the first
Welcome
three.
Welcome to public broadcast.
Yes, really.
Yeah,
hello. Hello, donate.
That's right.
But we didn't have a lot of money, and we shot the first three episodes simultaneously. So it was like doing one big feature, and we did it in 24 days. It was interesting to try to keep the episodes separated, continuity, for example. So the actors had a challenge ahead of them, and we all worked together as a team trying to tell what I think are some really great and unique stories and completely relevant stories to our time.
It's enjoyable. And I saw the first one last week, and I'll watch again this coming weekend. It was a little rough to watch, though. Civil War Hospital, it's a little gruesome, a little gory.
There are no battlefields.
No, but there's like people sawing off legs.
Well, that happens.
Come on, I know, but...
That happens.
It's a little... Ew. I wonder what sort of guidance you got from the higher-ups at PBS who said, listen, we want you to do this thing.
Uh-huh.
Go make it our – and they probably didn't exactly say this, but I'm sure the inference was there. Make it our Downton Abbey, right?
Well, they knew it could not be Downton Abbey. We did know, and PBS did know, that we would appeal to a similar audience, mm-hmm. but that it's really not the same. And I think that if we try to make it that, that would be a problem. So, I mean, I think we can't avoid the comparisons, but we weren't trying to be similar.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about, I guess it's professional life as a director. Are you sort of a director for hire? Do you freelance? Do you call them? Do they call you? How do you get on a project? How did Mercy Street work?
It is a bit of a freelance, and sometimes I move from show to show. For Mercy Street, it was my first time to do a pilot, so I was with the show from the inception, and I went in, I met on it, and had certain ideas about how I wanted to tell the story, and they seemed very open to that.
So it's like a job interview?
Oh, absolutely. Huh. This, you really are starting it out from the very beginning. And I was very spoiled. I loved that. I really loved being able to be with this project from day one, from the inception.
You have been around for a while. And in this town.
Yes, thank you.
Well, there was no elegant way to ask that question, right? but you look really good. I point that out because... there's a lot going on in Hollywood and in entertainment today about diversity and women specifically and people
yes.
of color and how there just isn't enough of it. What do you suppose the industry is to do about that?
Well, I was hoping when I began this 10, 12 years ago directing an episode of television that it still wouldn't be an issue. I'm a little saddened that it's still an issue, and I would love it not to be an issue. And I think that what's hard is we're treading that fine line. You can't force people to hire, but yet at the same time, you just want to make them aware that they're missing a lot of opportunities. There are amazing women and people of color that are standing in the wings just ready to come and contribute. But I don't have that secret formula that will suddenly make it okay. I wish I did, but I think that we're in search of that right now. I think it's time. I think... We just want to be directors. We don't want to be female directors, you know?
Roxanne Dawson. The show is called Mercy Street. It's on PBS, episode 2 this Sunday.
Great.
Roxanne,
thanks so much. Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, picking up, sort of, where Roxanne Dawson and I left off. In the wake of the all-white Oscars controversy, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Board of Governors had a meeting last night, an emergency meeting, I should say. Here's the upshot. A promise to double the number of female and minority members by 2020. It's also going to review voting status for members who haven't been active in films in more than a decade. That's about the old white male membership thing. None of that, though, affects this year's Oscars, about which, as long as Leo doesn't win for The Revenant, I'm all right with that. All right, we got to go. An upending to a shaky week. The Dow gained 210 points today, about 1.33%. The NASDAQ up 119 points, 2.33%. The S&P 500 added 37 points, 2% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a good weekend, everybody. And if you're on the East Coast, be safe out there, huh? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.